Welcome to the infamous podcast, Bitch, I'm Not Well. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Brandy.
And we're invested on taking you down to Crazy Town, where we talk about crazy bitches who are truly unwell. All right.
About damn time.
I knows it.
I get to see you for 2 days and then I'm going.
I know. It's not fair. Life's not fair.
Y'all should come with us. Just show up over there.
I bet they would.
No, y'all.
I thought you meant the podcaster.
Oh, well, the podcaster. Y'all can come too.
No, please don't show up. That would be just weird. Okay. Yeah, but I might show up.
You could.
Okay, send me the address.
I guess Flip Flop can come along.
No.
He's uninvited.
No, today. You know why? Because he uninvited me to lunch yesterday.
What an asshole.
Right? He was going with it was a business lunch, supposedly. Yet they just talked about our trip to Europe. And I wasn't invited because I was like, ooh, I want some lasagna.
Who could better tell about your trip to Europe than you?
That's what I told him. I said I planned the whole damn thing. Because this guy was planning to go to Europe. And I was like, why is he talking to you?
You could have brought your binder.
Why is he talking to you? Because I planned the whole thing. And it was amazing. But anyway, let's get back down to business.
All right.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about Mary Bell.
She kind of looks like the Annabelle doll.
She looks like the Annabelle doll. And she's probably got the same thoughts as the Annabelle doll.
She's kind of creepy looking.
She was an 11-year-old serial killer.
What?
Yes, ma'am. Oh, Mary Flora Bell, born May 26, 1957, is an English woman who, as a juvenile, killed two preschool-age boys in Scotswood, an inner suburb of Newcastle upon Tyne, in 1968. So she was 11. Technically 10 years old. It was the day before her birthday.
Oh, so it's like a birthday gift to herself.
Oh,
that's really messed up.
That's a little messed up.
Sorry.
Oh, in both instances, Bell informed her victim that he had a sore throat, which she would massage before proceeding to strangle them.
What?
Yeah. So she convinced them that they had a sore throat. Here, huh. Let me see your throat. But they were young, you know, like really young.
I'm four. I guess you know better than me, 11-year-old.
Bell was convicted of manslaughter in relation to both killings in December 1968 in a trial held at Newcastle Assizes.
Assizes?
It's probably Assizes.
I think so. I like it better the way you pronounced it.
So she was 11 years old. Her actions were judged to have been committed under diminished responsibility.
How do you even, like, know I should... I mean, I guess you don't say I should kill somebody, but at 11, I'm going to just strangle you and see what happens.
We're going to go into more of her story, like her very early childhood. And I think she's been pretty traumatized.
Well, I guess that would be a hint for her.
Yes. I think to this day, she remains Britain's youngest female killer. And she was diagnosed with a psychopathic personality disorder prior to her trial. Her alleged accomplice in at least one of the killings was 13-year-old Norma Joyce Bell.
Were they related?
Nope.
Oh.
They actually were not.
Wow.
And Norma was acquitted of all charges.
Was she scared that Mary was going to kill her too?
I don't know, but I think I would have been.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Bell was released from custody in 1980 at the age of 23.
What?
Mm-hmm. A lifelong court order granted her anonymity.
No.
Which has since been extended to protect the identity of her daughter and her granddaughter.
What?
So she went on to have a child and a granddaughter. And she's like changed her name several times because I guess people have recognized her or whatever. But yeah, No, she's out there living her life.
How would you like that for your neighbor?
I guess nobody ever, you don't really know who your neighbors are sometimes,
do you? I
guess
so. And the sweet little lady that lived next door to me asked me to babysit my kids and be like,
no, thank you.
Hard pass.
Well, they had a sore throat.
So, liar!
This is what happened. Okay, so let me tell you about Mary Bell's birth and life.
Okay.
So Mary Bell's mother, Elizabeth Betty Bell. Betty Bell.
Kind of like Betty Boop.
Kind of, yes. Reminds me of that. Was a well-known local prostitute.
Oh.
Or a sex worker who often left her children alone to fend for themselves while she was working.
Oh, good luck, everyone.
Betty's husband was rarely home himself. So they really did just raise themselves, you know.
Yeah.
Betty was only 17 years old when Mary, her second child, was born May 26, 1957.
There's no way I could have one kid at 17, let alone two. I couldn't even take care of myself.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you would think that you would have some kind of protection or, you know, being in the biz.
Yeah.
The identity of Mary's biological father is unknown. For most of her life, Mary believed that her father was William Billy Bell. There's another one.
Billy Bell.
Betty Bell, Billy Bell. Say that fast five times.
Oh, my God.
Billy was a violent alcoholic and habitual criminal with an arrest record for crimes, including armed robbery.
Seems like a stand-up guy.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
I would definitely claim him as my baby daddy.
Yes, definitely. I'd probably get a t-shirt.
Billy, my daddy.
Billy, my bell. You can ring my bell. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry for that. Okay. However, she was a baby when William Bell married her mother, and it is unknown if he is her actual biological father.
Hmm.
I mean, you consider the mentality, maybe so. Mary was an unwanted and neglected child. According to her aunt, Issa McCricket.
Oh, I like Issa.
Within minutes of Mary's birth, her mother shouted at the hospital staff to take that thing away from me when they tried to put Mary in her arms.
Why would you let her leave the hospital with the baby?
Maybe they thought she was just going through it at the time. Who knows? I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
There's so many things that are happening here.
That's terrible.
Yeah. As a baby, toddler, and young child, Mary frequently suffered injuries and household accidents while in the care of her mother, which led to her family to believe that either her mom was deliberately negligent, intentionally attempting to harm or kill her daughter.
Dang.
Now,
if you thought that, why would you not go take the child?
Right, and they actually did offer to take her, but Betty refused. I don't know.
I wonder why.
She had a whipping post. Who knows? On one occasion in 1960, Betty dropped Mary from a first floor window. Mary would have been between 2 and 3 years old at this time.
By first floor, do you think they mean like 3 feet above the ground? Or do you think they mean
that there was probably a stoop or a landing? So your first floor is probably your actual second floor here in the United States.
Okay. Okay. So probably like 10 to 15 feet off the ground?
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Cool.
Cool.
That's a long way to fall for a 2 or 3 year old. I break my hip.
On another occasion, she overdosed her daughter with sleeping pills.
What?
Mm-hmm. She also sold Mary to a mentally unstable woman who was unable to have children of her own. Mary's older sister, Catherine, traveled across Newcastle to reclaim Mary from this individual and return the child to her mother's home on White House Road.
I mean, do they have this in the wanted ads? Like, unstable woman looking to adopt child will pay 5 cents per pound? Like,
I don't know. Maybe it was one of her clients' wives.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy. Why would you sell your child?
I don't know. Because she didn't want to give her to family. She refused repeated offers to take custody.
I mean, if her family would have offered to pay for the kid, would you think she would have given it to him?
Possibly. I don't know.
That's crazy.
But then there's this. This is the actual worst.
I wonder how old her sister was when she went to travel across the country to get her.
I don't think she was very old because Mary was born when her mother was 17.
Mm-hmm.
So she couldn't have been... I mean, what's the youngest you can have a baby? I mean, like,
Henry, who knows? The seventh's mom was 13.
Okay, so 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. So she's 4 years older.
Yeah,
so she 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, maybe 11 at the most.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm thinking that she just learned that she could make money off of Mary. She began to allow and encourage several of her clients to sexually abuse her.
What?
And this happened in 1960 when Mary was between the age of 2 and 3 years old.
What?
Yes. And these sessions were known to be sadomasochism.
What is that?
It's the act of inflicting or receiving pain or humiliation to another person
for pleasure. To a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old? That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. And
Or, I mean, to anybody, yeah. But that's a baby.
And her mother actively participated in several of the sessions.
What's wrong with this bitch? Mm-hmm.
She blindfolded her daughter with a stocking before restraining her hands behind her back and forced her to perform oral sex on her clients.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, what do you...
I think Mary's mom's throat hurt. Mary should have gone and taken care of that one first.
Okay, so both at home and at school, of course. I mean, you put a child through all this.
Yeah.
You beat them, you neglect them, you put them through these...
You drop them out of a window, you sell them.
Horrific events. And then you're shocked when she's disturbed and has unpredictable behavior, mood swings, chronic bedwetting. She frequently fought with other kids, like boys and girls, and she attempted to strangle or suffocate her classmates or playmates on several occasions.
Like, as a teacher, how do you write a note home about that?
One of the times she tried to strangle or block the trachea of a young girl with sand.
Oh my God. So she's like shoving sand down her throat.
Shoving sand down her throat. Ugh. Mm-hmm. So, of course, all this violent behavior made many of the kids a little reluctant to socialize with Mary.
I could see not wanting to go to her birthday party.
She had a hard time finding friends.
I don't think I'd want to go spend the night if she invited me.
Yeah, yeah.
Even now.
So, Mary actually found a friend who was a neighbor around 1967. This is when this happened. She was 2 years older than her, and her name was Norma Joyce Bell, like I said in the beginning, which... was her accomplice, and Norma got off, and no, they're not related. So she did eventually find a friend, which, you know, considering everything that happened to her, even though she was mentally deranged, probably as a result of all of it.
I'm sure.
I'm at least glad that she found a little friend. According to one classmate, by 1968, she and her peers had become accustomed to the sudden and marked changes in Mary's behavior. And when she began exhibiting distressful mannerisms, including shaking her head and forming a steely gaze, her peers instinctively knew that she was about to become violent. And with the focus of her stare being the individual she would attack, all hands on deck. Like,
oh, I would not make eye contact. I'd be
running.
Please don't let me sit by her.
Yeah. So... you're sitting there in class and or on the playground. Let's say on the playground. Mm. And all of a sudden, she starts shaking her head. And then she stops and she's staring at you like,
oh, God, what did I do?
You're mine. Bye.
Mom, I don't feel good. Come pick me up.
My tummy hurts. Come get me.
Everything hurts and I'm dying.
It's going to hurt. My throat
is going to hurt, Mama. Trust me.
I know. I just want to live. Okay. On Saturday, the 11th of May in 1968, a 3-year-old boy was discovered wandering around dazed and bleeding in the vicinity of St. Margaret's Road in Scottswood. The child later informed police that he had been playing with Mary and Norma Bell atop an abandoned air raid shelter when he had been pushed about 7 feet from the roof to the ground.
Wow.
Which inflicted a severe laceration to his head. He was unsure of which of the girls had actually pushed him. The same evening, the parents of 3 small girls contacted the police to complain that both Mary and Norma had attempted to strangle their children as they played in a sand pit.
So they pushed someone off of a...
pushed somebody off, a little boy off the roof, who was 3 years old, doesn't really know what the hell is going on. I mean, that's my grandson's 3. He wouldn't know what, like, he wouldn't know.
Yeah, who would, yeah. 3-year-olds don't understand.
Right. And then they get a complaint that, you know, Mary and Norma had also tried to strangle 3 kids in a sand pit.
That's an eventful day.
Yeah. So they went to investigate and both girls were interviewed. And, of course, they both denied any responsibility for the air raid shelter incident, claiming they simply discovered the boy bleeding heavily from an open wound after he had fallen. They further questioned about the attempted strangulation of the 3 young girls, and Mary denied any knowledge of the incident. However, Norma admitted that Mary had tried to throttle each of the girls, stating, "What happens if you choke someone? Do they die?" Then Mary put both hands around the girl's throat and squeezed. The girl started to go purple. What? I told Mary to stop, but she wouldn't. Then she put her hands around Pauline's throat, and she started going purple as well. Another girl, Susan Cornish, came up, and Mary did the same thing to her.
I don't think I'd be going up to Mary.
No. Police notified the local authority of the incidents and of Mary's violent nature, but due to their age, both girls were simply given a warning. No further action was taken.
Ah, you're fine, girl. Go home. Don't do it again, please.
Now. You've been warned.
That'll show them.
Don't go around choking people. Like, how many kids has she tried to choke by this point?
Yeah.
Her classmates, the sand in the girl's throat, pushing the boy off the roof, trying to choke three other girls.
I guess back in the day, there really wasn't any help for kids like this. It was just like, nah, they'll grow out of it.
I guess not. On May the 25th, 1968, the day before her 11th birthday, Belle strangled 4-year-old Martin Brown in an upstairs bedroom of a derelict house located at 85 St. Margaret's Road. She is believed to have committed this crime alone. Brown's body was discovered by three children at approximately 3:30 p.m. He was lying on his back with his arms stretched above his head. Aside from specks of blood and foam around his mouth, no signs of violence were visible upon his body.
He didn't have, like, marks on his neck or anything? Just blood? I guess maybe he bit his tongue or something?
Let's read on.
Let's continue.
A local workman named John Hall soon arrived on the scene and attempted to perform CPR to no avail. As Hall attempted CPR, two local girls, 10-year-old Mary Bell, locally known as May, and her 13-year-old friend and neighbor, Norma Bell, appeared at the doorway to the bedroom. Both were quickly shooed out of the house. The two knocked on the door of Martin's aunt, Rita Finlay, and informed her, "One of your sister's kids has just had an accident. We think it's Martin, but we can't tell because there's blood all over him."
Oh, wow.
So, not only did they kill this boy and leave, they came back to be nosy, to see what was going on. You know, is he going to be revived or not?
Yeah.
Then they go to his aunt's house and say, "Oh, one of your nephews, yeah, he's been in a bad accident."
Yeah.
The following day, Bernard Knight conducted a postmortem on the body of Martin Brown. Knight was unable to find any signs of violence on the child's body and thus was unable to determine the child's cause of death, although he was able to discount the investigator's theory that the child died of poisoning through ingesting tablets.
Why would they think that?
I guess from the foam and the blood around his mouth.
Okay.
An inquest on June 7th returned an open verdict. So I don't know. I mean,
so he may not have died of strangling, or is that what Mary said once she was finally caught, that she had strangled him or she throttled him?
Well, that throttling was the three girls in the sand pit.
Oh, okay.
We're not really sure what happened to this little boy, only that they were there.
Hmm.
On Mary's 11th birthday, May 26th, she and Norma broke into and vandalized a nursery in nearby Woodland Crescent. The two entered the premises by peeling tiles off the slate roof. What? Okay, you're 11 years old, and you're pulling ceramic tiles. You know, I guess over there they've got the, you know, the tiles, the shingles for their, like the tile shingles.
Yeah.
So they start peeling these suckers off so they can get inside.
How do you even think to do that at 11 and 13?
I don't know.
I have nothing else to do today. Let's go peel shingles off of a roof.
Yeah, and break into a nursery. This is a baby, you know, a child's nursery. So they tore up books, turned desk over, smeared ink and poster paints all over the property before escaping.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. The following day, staff discovered the break-in and vandalism and immediately notified the police, who also discovered four separate notes left behind.
So nobody noticed two children on the top of a building peeling off tiles?
Peeling off tiles. I guess not. Huh. You know, must have been a small little community. Yeah. Everybody's night-night. Who knows? So they left four notes behind. One of the notes stated, "I murder so that I may come back." Don't even...
Like, I'm going to be reincarnated or maybe. I'm never going to die, so I murder people to make my life last longer.
Those all sound legit.
I'm pretty smart.
You are very smart. Another read, "We did murder Martin Brown. Fuck off, you bastard." And I'm not reading these like they actually spelled them because they're very confusing if you do so.
Yes.
A third note simply read, "Fuck off, we murder." Watch out, Fanny and Faggot. I only assume that they call themselves Fanny and Faggot.
Yeah, like by the last note, whenever you read it, mm-hmm. it sounds like they're referring to themselves as that. In right. this note that you just read, it almost sounds like they're calling somebody that.
Right, yes. But
it does. I'm with you. I think that's what they call themselves.
Yes. So here's the final note. You are mice. Why? Because we murdered Martin Brown. You better look out. There are murders about by Fanny and old Faggot, you screws. So, yeah, by that, I'm thinking that they call themselves Fanny and Faggot.
That and sentence that you just read reminds me of a really good saying about commas save lives. Have you?
Yeah, it is. It's a run-on sentence.
I had this shirt and it says, let's eat children. But it should be, let's eat, comma, children.
A comma can save your life, truly.
It really can.
It makes all the change. Please use your commas wisely.
Pretty please.
Please use them at all.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So the police dismissed this incident as a tasteless and childish prank.
That's pretty spot on. Should be a tasteless and childish prank.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so 2 days later, on May 29th, shortly before the funeral of Martin Brown, in a game of chicken, both girls called upon the house of his mother, June, asking to see her son.
The dead kid? Oh my gosh.
When June Brown replied that they could not see her son because he was deceased, Mary replied, "Oh, I know he's dead. I just want to see him in his coffin."
Wow.
How?
I would beat the crap out of my child.
Well, her mother wasn't around to hear it.
Yeah, that's true.
And probably didn't care.
She terrible. Like, that poor mom.
Can you imagine?
Can
you imagine?
I'd go crazy.
On the afternoon of July 31st, 1968, a three-year-old named Brian Howe was last seen by his parents in the street outside his house playing with one of his siblings, the family dog, and Mary and Norma Bell. When he didn't return home later that afternoon, concerned relatives and neighbors searched the streets without success. At 10 after 11 p.m., a search party discovered Brian's body between two large concrete blocks up on the 10 Lizzie. So the 10 Lizzie, I think, was just a place where the locals referred to a certain section of the neighborhood. The first policeman to arrive at the scene observed that a deliberate but feeble attempt had been made to conceal the body, which was covered in clumps of grass and weeds. Cyanosis was evident upon the child's lips, and several bruises and scratches were evident upon his neck. A pair of broken scissors lay close to his feet. The coroner would conclude that Brian had died of strangulation and that he had been deceased for up to 7.5 hours before the discovery of his body. The killer had evidently squeezed Brian's nostrils closed with one hand, as he or she had gripped his throat with the other. Numerous puncture wounds had been inflicted to the child's legs before death.
Oh my gosh!
Sections of his hair had been cut from his head. His genitals had been partially mutilated.
Oh!
And a cruel attempt had been made to carve the initial M into his stomach.
Oh my God!
The relatively small amount of force used to murder this child led the coroner to conclude that the killer was another child.
That makes me think that one of the girls strangled him and the other one held their hand over his nose or held his nose closed.
Could have been both of them. Numerous gray and maroon fibers were discovered upon Brian's clothing and shoes. These fibers did not source from any clothing within the Howe household, and had been transferred to the child by his killer.
That's crazy that even back then they could compare fibers and see.
I know. That.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The discovery of Brian Howe's body sparked a large-scale manhunt. Over 100 detectives from across Northumberland were assigned to the investigation, and more than 1,200 children had been questioned with regard to their whereabouts by August the 2nd.
Holy crap, there must have been a lot of kids around there.
Oh, I'm sure. Two children questioned by detectives on August 1st were Mary Bell and Norma Bell, who, witnesses informed investigators, had been seen playing with Brian shortly before he was believed to have died.
So if the first report of them trying to strangle little girls.
Ding, 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 ding.
Like, if that would have been documented at all, you would think they'd be like, okay, well, we need to go check out these two little bitches because...
Yeah.
And they showed up at the second crime scene and...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... I would have saved them from having to question 1,998 kids.
Yeah, right. Yeah, truly. In her initial interview, Norma seemed excitable, like nervous, I guess.
Hmm.
Whereas Mary was markedly more observant and like intact. Like she was focused.
Like not concerned about this? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Although both girls were evasive and contradictory in their initial statements, they freely admitted to having played with Brian on the date of his death, but denied having seen him after lunchtime.
Liars.
Well, maybe they killed him before lunch.
Maybe so.
It's time for a sandwich. Let's get this over with.
I'm so hungry.
Questioned further the following day, Mary stated she remembered seeing an 8-year-old local boy playing with Brian in the afternoon of July 31st, and that she had also seen him hitting the child. Furthermore, she stated she also remembered that the boy had been covered in grass and weeds as if he had been rolling in a field, and that he had in his possession a small pair of scissors.
Huh.
Gee, Mary, how could you know all these facts?
How did you see that tiny pair of scissors in his hand?
Wow, she is super observant.
And weren't they broken by the dead kid's feet?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mary then expounded, I saw him trying to cut a cat's tail off with the scissors, but there was something wrong with them. One leg was broken or bent on the scissors. Like, so yeah, she's admitting.
Oh my God, I wonder if she tried to do that to a cat.
Right.
Better stay away from my cat.
The self-incriminating statement convinced Detective Chief Inspector James Dobson that Mary was the actual killer, as only the police knew about the broken scissors found at the crime scene. In addition, the local boy she named was quickly questioned and was discovered to have been at Newcastle International Airport on the day of July 31st with numerous witnesses to be able to corroborate his parents' claim.
So she didn't even know if the kid was in town.
Yeah. Like,
God, Mary, you're a murderer and a liar.
Yeah. On the afternoon of August the 4th, the parents of Norma Bell contacted the police stating that their daughter wished to confess what she knew of the death of Brian Howe. DCI Dobson arrived at their home, formally cautioned Norma, and then asked what she knew. Norma then informed Dobson that Mary had taken her to a spot on the 10 Lizzie, at which point she had been shown Brian's body. Mary had then demonstrated to her how she strangled the child. According to Norma, Mary had confessed to her that she enjoyed strangling the child before describing how she inflicted the scour marks to his stomach with a razor blade, which had been hidden at the crime scene, and the broken scissors. Norma then led police to the crime scene and revealed the location where the razor blade was hidden.
Hmm.
A drawing Norma made of the wounds inflicted to the boy's abdomen precisely matched those described by the coroner.
I have a hard time believing that she had no part in this.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Mary Bell was visited in her home in the early hours of August the 5th. On this occasion, she was notably defensive when confronted with the discrepancies in her previous statement informing detectives, "You're trying to brainwash me. I will get a solicitor," that means a lawyer, "to get me out of this." How do you know at 11?
Maybe her parents have said it multiple
times. You know, this is true.
They're in trouble all the time.
This is true. She was probably privy to all this information.
Yes. Yeah, she's like, oh, right. Hang on, Mom. I'm going to call my mom's solicitor. Mm-hmm. She's got a deal with him.
Got him on speed dial. We don't even have speed dial yet.
It's an on your back, on your stomach type of deal.
Oh. Oh.
Mama.
Ugh. All right. Later the same day, Norma was questioned again. On this occasion, she made a full statement in which she admitted being present when Mary had actually strangled Brian. Mm-hmm.
So the first time she was not there.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Now she's admitting to being there. According to Norma, when the trio were alone on the 10 Lizzie, Mary seemed to go all funny, pushing the child into the grass and attempting to strangle him before stating to her, "My hands are getting thick. Take over." I don't know what that means.
Hmm.
Like maybe...
maybe they're getting sore?
Hard to hold him, you know?
Yeah.
She had then run from the scene, leaving Mary alone with Brian. So after Mary started, you know, Mary wanted Norma to take over for her.
She ran away.
She says she ran away.
Instead of, you know, stopping her?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. A forensic examination of clothing owned by both girls revealed the gray fibers discovered upon Brian's body were a precise match to a woolen dress owned by Mary. The maroon fibers upon the child's shoes were a precise match to a skirt owned by Norma.
So Norma probably held his legs down.
And probably stabbed his legs. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the same gray fibers had also been found upon the body of Martin Brown. So that's how they tied the death of Martin Brown to Mary Bell as well.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. They should have done a handwriting analysis to see if she wrote the notes confessing to murdering him.
Well, so the notes, going back to the notes, and I mentioned that I didn't read them as they were written,
mm-hmm.
but the word fuck on one note was spelled correctly. On the other note, it was F-U-C-H. So there were clearly two different people writing these notes.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Well, nobody would know. And I mean, if you're listening to the podcast, if you've read all about this already and you've read the notes, then but there's no way you would have known. So Brian Howe was buried in a local cemetery on August the 7th, 1968, in a ceremony attended by over 200 people. According to DCI Dobson, who had planned to arrest both girls later that day, Mary Bell stood outside the Howe household as the child's coffin was brought from the home at the beginning of the funeral procession.
What?
Dobson later stated she stood there laughing, laughing and rubbing her hands. I thought, my God, I've got to bring her in. She'll do another one.
That is crazy.
Yeah. That was...
How did nobody else but him...
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know.
I'm sure other people knew.
Yeah, other people probably saw it and were like, what is
going on here?
This is just not normal, you know. Both girls were formally charged with the murder of Brian Howe at 8 p.m. that evening. In response to this charge, Mary replied, "That's all right by me." Norma burst into tears, simply proclaiming, I'll pay you back for this. Okay.
Like she told Mary
telling Mary, yeah, I'll pay you back for this. In the presence of an independent witness, Mary prepared a written statement in which she admitted to being present when Brian Howe was murdered, but insisted that the murder had been committed by Norma. She also admitted that she and Norma had broken into the Woodland Crescent Nursery the day after the killing of Martin Brown, defacing the property before the two had written the four handwritten notes. Shortly after their arrest, both girls underwent psychological evaluations.
I'm assuming they failed.
Yeah. Big time. The results of these tests revealed Norma was intellectually delayed and a submissive character who easily displayed emotion, whereas Mary was a bright yet cunning character prone to sudden mood swings. Occasionally, Mary was willing to talk, although she rapidly became sullen, introspective, and defensive in nature. So at first she was all like, that's all right by me. And now she's like,
I'm not telling you.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Almost like two different personalities.
The four psychiatrists who examined Mary concluded that, although not suffering from a mental disorder, she suffered from a psychopathic personality disorder. In his official report compiled for the Director of Public Prosecutions, David Westbury concluded Mary's social techniques are primitive and take the form of automatic denial, ingratiation. Now, what does that mean?
The act of deliberately trying to gain someone's favor or good graces, often through insincere or manipulative means.
I gotcha. Okay.
Sounds just like Mary.
Yeah. Manipulation, complaining, bullying, flight, or violence. So these are all the techniques that she used to manipulate people.
It's weird that they say that she automatically denied because she didn't, according to... when they first talked to her, right? Didn't she admit?
Right, but this is his, you know, afterwards she shut down.
Okay.
Remember, like, that's what I was saying. Like, at first she was like, oh, yeah, it's all right by me. You can take me in. And
Okay.
But she did say that Norma did it all.
That's true.
So she did have a denial. All right, so the trial of Mary Bell and Norma Bell for the murders of Martin Brown and Brian Howe began at Newcastle Assizes on December the 5th, 1968. Both girls were tried before Mr. Justice Cusack and a jury, and both pleaded not guilty to the charges. Mary was defended by Harvey Robson, QC, Norma by R.P. Smith, QC. right. So
RP must have been better than Harvey.
Well,
because one got off and one did not.
Against protests from both defense counsel, on the first day of the trial jury waived the defendant's right to anonymity on account of their age.
Mm.
As such, the media were allowed to publicize the names, ages, photographs of both girls. So I wonder what changed his mind to give her anonymity after
after the fact. You've already been, we figured out you're guilty and you did this, so now we're going to protect you.
Mm-hmm. So each of the girls sat alongside plain-clothed female police officers in the center of the court, behind their legal representatives, and within arm's reach of their families throughout the duration of the trial.
So they were tried together.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it. Rudolph Lyons, QC, opened the case on behalf of the prosecution at 11:30 a.m. in an opening statement lasting 6 hours.
Goal!
Lyons informed the jury that they faced an unhappy and distressing task due to the nature of murders and the ages of the defendants. He then outlined the prosecution's intent to illustrate the similarities between both murders, which indicated both boys had been murdered by the same perpetrator or perpetrators.
I would be a really shitty juror because I'm pretty sure I would start zoning out.
After 6 hours?
Oh, yeah.
I need a coffee break.
Yeah, I've got a potty. I need some coffee, maybe a Coke. Can I have a shot of caffeine? Like, I'm going to need something here.
I know. Lyons outlined the circumstances surrounding both details and the evidence indicating the defendant's guilt. Now, this was his opening statement. Our podcast won't even be 45 minutes, and he's up there for 6 hours.
I wonder what he, like, so on this day, 12 years ago.
An opening statement? Like,
how did you have anything else to say? Like, did you give him the whole case right there and then you just reiterated throughout?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We just need a synopsis. Yeah. Just give us a snapshot.
Just let us know.
Yeah. Okay, so although Lyons conceded in his opening statement that despite the defendant's age difference, Mary was much more dominant of the two. He contended both girls had acted in unison and were equally culpable killing both children solely for the pleasure and excitement of murder, adding both girls well knew what they did was wrong and what the results would be.
I agree.
Now, the defense, however, on the fifth day of the trial,
they finally got to talk?
They got to talk on the fifth day.
Okay.
Norma testified in her own defense. She denied any culpability in the actual murder of either child, but admitted under cross-examination to having known Mary's penchant for violence in her history of attacking children, and that the two had discussed attacking and killing small children of both genders.
Well, it sounds like anybody who went to school or lived near Mary would know for her penchant of violence. I
mean, that's great. Oh, my gosh. Questioned by Rudolph Lyons as to whether Mary had demonstrated to her how children could be killed, Norma nodded yes. She then conceded that, as Mary had begun to attack and strangle Brian Howe, she had failed to alert a group of boys playing in the vicinity, stating that she failed to do so as, "I did not know what was going to happen in the first place." She had stopped hurting him for a bit when the boys were near the concrete blocks.
This is her fifth time trying to murder someone. Uh-huh. So how did you not know what was going to happen? I guess maybe she thought she was going to stop.
She thought she was going to stop and let go, I guess. Because she was there with the first little boy.
Yeah. I find it hard to believe.
Yeah.
No, if she felt bad or was scared of Mary, she would have stopped hanging out with her after the first kid.
No. If she was, you know, mentally challenged, maybe that's why it didn't register.
Maybe so.
When she was questioned as her own role in the murder, Norma stated that she had never touched the child. Following the conclusion of Norma's testimony on December the 12th, Mary testified in her defense. Her testimony lasted for almost 4 hours, concluding on December 13th, and was briefly adjourned on one occasion when she began crying in a police woman's arms. She denied her co-defendant's accusations, insisting that although she had observed the body of Martin Brown at St. Margaret's Road, she herself had never harmed the child, and that she and Norma had later asked the boy's mother to view his body as the two were daring each other, and one of us did not want to be a chicken. Mary also conceded that she had divulged to others the knowledge of Martin's death could get Norma put straight away.
I would like to know who you told that to.
Right? Questions with regards to the death of Brian Howe. Mary claimed that Norma had been the individual who had strangled the child as she herself was just standing and looking. I couldn't move. It was as if some glue was pulling us down. Mary then alleged Norma had encouraged Brian to lie down if he wanted some sweets, telling him, "You've got to lie down for the lady to come with the sweets." Before proceeding to strangle him with her bare hands as she herself unsuccessfully attempted to prevent the attack.
Doubtful.
Mary further stated that she could determine the level of force Norma had exhibited because her fingertips and nails were going white.
How close was she?
She was it was her fingernails.
It was her fingernails.
And again conceded that she had failed to inform authorities of her knowledge of Norma's actions out of both a fear and misguided sense of loyalty.
See, I feel like both of those
How
girls...
How loyal are you?
If it would have only been one of them after the first time, yeah. The second one that didn't have anything to do with it would have told someone.
Absolutely. Yeah. Norma's mother, Catherine, then testified that several months prior to the killing of Brian Howe, she and her husband had discovered Mary attempting to strangle Norma's younger sister, Susan.
And you still let her play with her?
What is going on?
Man, parents of the year right there. Look, Norma, you can hang out with her because she hasn't tried to strangle you yet, but please don't bring her around your younger sister.
Oh, and it was like a big, it was a big thing because Mary didn't release her grip until Susan's husband punched Mary in the shoulder to let her go.
What?
Like, they probably thought they were roughhousing, like, oh, they're just playing.
Gosh.
Let her go.
All right, Norma, go spend the night with Mary. We me and your dad have to talk.
A child psychiatrist named Ian Frazier then testified that Norma's mental age was 8 years and 10 months. How did they go to 10 months?
I don't know, but I still feel like an 8-year-old would know that you shouldn't strangle someone, especially an 8-year-old and 10-month-old.
Well, yes, and he did say that. He said, although her capacity of knowing right from wrong was limited, she was capable of appreciating the criminality of the act she was accused of committing. Otherwise, she would not have lied.
Yeah, thank you, Ian. Yeah. I'm glad we agree on something.
Yeah. So, on December the 13th, Norma's defense counsel, R.P. Smith, delivered his closing argument to the jury. Smith emphasized that although both girls were on trial together, no real evidence existed against his client. Excuse me, what about the maroon fibers on his shoes?
Yeah.
And the only evidence against Norma was Mary's accusations against her. Smith implored the jurors to suppress feelings of outrage and malice and dispel any idea that both little girls pay for the actions of one of them.
Well, Norma, even if she didn't do anything, she was there.
Mm-hmm.
She should have done something.
She should have.
Hey, stop or go get someone. Or the group of little boys.
Some kind of punishment, yeah.
Yeah.
Harvey Robson then delivered his closing argument on behalf of Mary. Robson illustrated her broken background and dysfunctional family and the blur between fantasy and reality in her mind. Robson also referenced the testimony of David Westbury, who had testified himself on behalf of the defense. He had interviewed Mary on several occasions prior to the trial and formed a definite view. The child suffered from a serious personality disorder, which he classified as a retarded development of her mind.
So Mary was not slower, but like developmentally...
A development of her mind, I guess, in the way that she could not distinguish between real and not real.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And that I believe because at 3 years old, you've got, I bet your mind will always protect you. Like,
yeah, you've been sexually assaulted and thrown out of a window and then sold.
Yeah, like your brain is putting you somewhere else. Like, this is not happening.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really at Disneyland or something. I don't know.
I don't know how she wasn't taken from her mother well before any of this happened.
Yep.
I mean, you don't hear anything about her sister in this, so.
Mm-mm. That was, and that this had been caused by both genetic and environmental factors.
Agree.
This abnormality, Westbury had contended, had impaired Mary's actual responsibility for her acts. Referencing the notes both girls had left in a nursery after the killing of Martin Brown, Robson states the notes proved the crimes were a childish fantasy, and in Mary's case, were written to attract attention to herself. Well, now she's getting attention and she don't want it.
Yeah.
In his closing argument, Rudolph Lyons described the case as a macabre and grotesque one, which it was, in which Mary, clearly the more domineering of the two, despite being the younger girl, wielded a very compelling influence reminiscent of the fictional Svengali over Norma, who he conceded was of subnormal intelligence, stating, "I forecast to you that the younger girl, although 2 years and 2 months younger than the other, was nevertheless the cleverer and more dominating personality." Outlining the numerous lies that Mary told the police and court alike, Lyons further remarked of Mary's lack of remorse and her high degree of cunning.
So I'm wondering why he only did the 2 years and 2 months. Like, how many days, minutes, hours, seconds?
Yeah, I know.
I'm a psycho.
2 years, 2 months, 42 minutes, and 38 seconds.
Oh, that 38 seconds made a big difference in my opinion.
Huge.
Yes.
Huge.
Yes.
If we forgo those 38 seconds, it would have been the other way around.
Yeah. She definitely wouldn't have been compliant in this. Mm-hmm. She would have been the underdog or whatever.
All right. So the trial lasted 9 days. It's not very long.
No.
On December 17th, the jury retired to consider their verdict and would deliberate for 3 hours and 25 minutes.
Oh.
These people are precise.
They are. They weren't even in there long enough to get a meal.
They made their verdict that Mary Bell was cleared of murder, but convicted of the manslaughter of both boys on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Norma Bell was acquitted of all charges. Upon hearing the jury's verdicts, Norma clapped her hands in excitement, whereas Mary burst into tears as her mother and grandmother also wept. Like, her mother gave two shits about her.
Now her mom cares.
Yeah, right?
This is going to look so bad on me.
Don't worry, think? Betty. You were already in.
Yeah, Betty, we already knew you were a terrible mom.
Yeah. Passing sentence, Mr. Justice Cusack described Bell as a dangerous individual, adding she posed a very grave risk to other children and that steps must be taken to protect the public from her. She was sentenced to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, effectively an indefinite sentence of imprisonment. So she went to jail without even knowing how long she was going to be in jail.
Well, she wasn't in there for very long.
I like how they say with Her Majesty's pleasure. Like, just to make your sentence sound better. Like, yeah. I should be honored.
As long as she's pleased with me.
I guess I can do this.
How long are you going to be pleased, Your Majesty?
How long can I pleasure you? Is there a time frame here?
What exactly do you prefer?
Yeah. When will be the peak of your pleasurement? Because that's what I'm looking for. I'm just looking to get right in there.
Get in and get out.
Get in and get out. At the time of Bell's manslaughter convictions, she was only 11 years and 6 months old, making her Britain's youngest female killer, a statistic which remains to the present day.
That would be kind of scary if somebody else had beaten her.
Yeah. So Bell was initially detained at Durham Remand Home before being transferred to a second remand home in South Norwood. She was then transferred to Red Bank Secure Unit, a young offenders institution in Newton Le Willow's Merryside.
Oh, that sounds romantic.
Lovely.
It does.
I would like to have tea and biscuits there.
Agreed.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Probably not there, but maybe in that town.
But just at Merryside.
Yes.
Okay, sounds like a jolly place to be. So this was in 1969, and she was the only female among approximately 24 inmates.
Why would they put her with a bunch of guys?
Why did any of this have to happen? Bell would later claim that she was sexually abused by a member of staff and several inmates while incarcerated at this facility, claiming the sexual abuse began when she was 13.
So she'd been in prison for 2 years.
Yeah. In November 1973, at the age of 16, she was transferred to a secure wing of HM Prison Style in Cheshire. So she endured, 3 years?
Yeah.
Of being raped by inmates
with a bunch of guys.
Staff members?
Is the only female? That's...
Okay. Reportedly, Bell resented her transferral to this facility. And while incarcerated at HM Prison Style, Bill unsuccessfully applied for parole.
So she would have rather been at the place where she was.
I suppose. Maybe this other place was worse.
Man.
In June of 1976, Bill was transferred to Moore Court Open Prison, where she undertook a secretarial course. Good for her. 15 months later, in September 1977, Bell again made national headlines when she and another inmate, Annette Priest, escaped from this open prison.
What?
Uh-huh. Both escapees spent several days in the company of two young men in Blackpool, visiting the amusements and sleeping in various local hotels, where Bell used the alias Mary Robinson before the two parted company.
Wasn't Robinson one of their lawyers' names?
Yes.
That's her. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, JP. No, I don't know. I don't remember what his name was. Bell was arrested at the Derbyshire home of one of the men, Clive Shirtcliffe. No, I almost said Shitcliffe.
I was just about to say.
Okay.
Oh, man.
It's time. It's time to wrap up.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
We're getting like delirious. Okay. Having by this stage dyed her hair blonde in an effort to disguise her identity.
I wonder how blonde it was or if it was like that orange.
It's probably orange. You know, the hair dyes back in, in the 70s.
Straight bleach. Oh.
She was returned to custody that evening. Priest was arrested in Leeds days later. Bell's penalty for escaping was a loss of prison privileges for 28 days.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like it was worth it.
What kind of privileges would you have in prison anyway?
You're not going to get to go to the library for 28 days. Like, okay, well, can you just give me a couple really big books? I don't even need to go.
Yeah. See you next month. I'm leaving tomorrow.
I get to stay in here and just lay around. All right.
Uh-huh. And yeah, that sounds so nice right now.
I know, right?
Although I don't want to commit a crime to do it. Can I check myself in?
Yeah, is there like a check-in, check-out type thing?
In June 1979, the Home Office announced their decision to transfer Mary Bell to HM Prison, Askham Grange, an open category prison in the village of Askham Richard, in efforts to prepare her for her eventual release into society, which was planned for the following year. Beginning on November 1979, Bell worked first as a secretary, then as a waitress at a cafe in York Minster under supervision guidelines and efforts to prepare her for her eventual release. This is great. Bell was released from HM Prison Askham Grange. Askham, not me. In May 1980 at the age of 23. Having served almost 11 and a half years in custody, she was granted anonymity, including a new name, allowing her to start a new life elsewhere in the country under an assumed identity. Upon her release, a spokesperson is quoted as saying, "Bell wishes to be given a chance to live a normal life and to be left alone." Well,
she should have thought about
that. Your two little victims probably wanted to have a chance at life as well.
Mm-hmm.
4 years after her release from custody, on May 25th, 1984, Bell gave birth to a daughter. This would prove to be her only child. Her daughter knew nothing of her mother's past until 1998, when reporters discovered Bell's then-current location in a resort town on the Sussex coast, where both had been living for approximately 18 months. This media revelation forced Bell and her 14-year-old daughter to leave their home and be driven to a safe house by undercover officers. Both mother and daughter later relocated to another part of the UK. Bell has allegedly returned to Tyneside on several occasions in the years following her release. She is also alleged to have lived in this location for a time.
You think her and Norma are still friends?
Norma's dead.
Oh, well, so, then I guess not.
No. The right to anonymity granted Bell's daughter following her birth was originally only extended until she reached the age of 18. However, on the 21st of May, 2003, Bell won a high court battle to have her own anonymity. That reminds me of Nemo.
Yes.
Anonymity. And that of her daughter extended for life. This order was approved by Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, president of the family division, and was later updated to include Bell's granddaughter, who was born in January 2009, and referred to as Z, like the letter Z. The order also prohibits the divulging of any aspects of their lives which may identify them, which we have not. We have not broken any orders. I don't know where the hell she is. I don't want to know where the hell she is.
Nah.
Yeah.
We don't want to be friends.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in 1998, Bell collaborated with author Gita Sereny to provide an account of her life before and after her crimes for Sereny's 1998 book, cries unheard, the story of Mary Bell.
So she can tell people who she is, but nobody else can.
Yes.
I hope she didn't make any money off of this book.
You know she did. Within this book, Bell details the abuse she suffered as a child at the hands of her prostitute mother, whom Bell describes as a dominatrix, and she alleges several of her mother's clients. Others interviewed or relatives, friends, and professionals who knew her before, during, and after imprisonment.
You think anybody's going to say anything bad about her?
Mm. Well, maybe.
She might come back and find them.
This person is not a reference. Don't go to this person.
Yeah. Like, I did not know her. Wink, wink. She was a great person. Head shake. No.
Please don't tell her that.
Don't tell her where I live.
Keep my name out of the book, please. Yeah. She was great. Bell's current whereabouts are unknown and remain protected by the 2003 High Court order. According to Sereny, Bell does not claim she was wrongfully convicted and freely admits the abuse she suffered as a child does not excuse her crimes. So that's good that she at least recognizes that.
I hope she continues to recognize that.
Oh my God, me too. So we don't know if she's dead or alive or whatever.
What happened to Norma? You said she was dead.
I don't know what happened to old Norma. I know she died in 1989, and you just found on Reddit that...
Yeah, they say it was sounded like cancer, but nobody can find any obituary, and we did all kind of research, and she doesn't come up anywhere.
No. Anything you pull up for Norma,
it's really
Joyce Bell, is just strictly about Mary Bell, so... Which, you know, she had a huge part in these murders, and I don't understand, even... being mentally challenged, while she just was able to get off completely with no punishment.
Yeah, and disappear.
Yeah. So that is the story of Mary Bell.
That's really scary.
Yeah. If you recognize some mental instability in children, it needs to be addressed.
Yes.
Before they turn into little killers and
ruin their lives and others' lives.
And I think in today's world, she would have been taken out of her home. I hope she would have been taken out of her home.
I know. I hope she would, too. Especially after she was sold.
Yeah, right?
Or even at the hospital when the mom said to get that thing away from me.
Yeah, she would have been better off probably with the mentally unstable woman that couldn't have children.
Yeah.
I bet her sister regrets bringing her home.
Her mom kind of sounds mentally unstable, too. So, I mean, was Absolutely. It really a difference? One was blood-related and one wasn't?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you bring her from one to come back to...
One was sexually abusing her. Hopefully the other one wasn't and wouldn't have.
Yeah. So, that's it. Very depressing.
That is a really sad case. Thanks for reminding my dad, Kelly.
Very sad.
Yeah.
And I hadn't heard of it before.
You don't hear of many child murders like this.
No.
Thank God she was caught. Could you imagine what she could have grown into?
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe they righted... No, they didn't right the wrong whenever they put her in prison because she was continually raped.
Yeah.
So I guess she just mentally grew out of it. Or maybe she's responsible for deaths around England. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Unsolved mysteries.
Dun, dun, dun.
Unsolved chokings, anyone? All right. Well, hopefully we'll see you next week with another episode.
Of Bitches Who Are... Unwell.
Bye.
We appreciate you listening to our podcast. If you liked it, please give us a good rating. You can listen on your favorite podcast platform with new releases every Friday. Just search for Bitch I'm Not Well. Send us suggestions for an episode at b.tchimnotwell@gmail.com because Gmail won't let us use bitch. Or visit our website at www.bitchimnotwell.com for more podcasts and our fabulous merchandise.
We'll see you next week on another podcast about another crazy bitch who is truly unwell.